Sorry, it's hard, sir.
Welcome back to the Symposium on Agriculture's Contributions to Climate Change Solutions, Mitigation and Adaptation at Global and Regional Scales. We now turn, after a wonderful first session of providing overviews from the soils, agronomy and crops perspectives, and modeling perspectives, the role that modeling can play, we now turn to a global tour d'horizon across the whole world and the major agricultural regions thereof. And we start right here in North America with Jerry Hatfield, who is going to talk about climate change and agriculture in North America, impacts, adaptation, and mitigation potential. As we all know, Jerry, former president of ASA, is the director of the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment of USDA ARS. Jerry. Also, co-leader of AgMIP.
Before I give my talk, I have to give a commercial. I have many hats. One of those is as the lead for the National Climate Assessment Program. Tonight, we're going to have a public stakeholder meeting from 5:30 to 7:30 in room 212B. So if you want to know about National Climate Assessment, and it's a public input session to get your views of what we ought to be doing. So 5:30, room 212B, it's just around the corner here. But today I want to talk about climate change in agriculture, and I'm going to try to weave together this impacts, adaptation, mitigation all together. And I'm going to start this by looking at climate change in context. We do have increasing CO2. We have more increasing and variable temperatures. You heard this morning already this increasing variability in precipitation, both in seasonality as well as the intensity and frequency of storms. And so we've got all of these things that are coming together that really do impact agriculture, and they impact agriculture in many different ways. And so in looking at this, what I really begin to think about is the framework for how we really begin to look at agriculture. We have inputs, we've got the agricultural system, and we have outputs. And if we think about expanding that and a little bit more, our inputs to the agricultural system are the climate, the soil, the genetics, the nutrients, and the water, the cropping systems. And you can, I didn't have a long enough box to put every cropping system that exists in the world out there, but anything from corn, beans, wheat, sunflower, cotton, sorghum. But our outputs, when we think about this, are outputs in terms of grain, outputs in terms of forage, but in reality we often stop there. But when we start thinking about agricultural systems in the larger context, as Chuck talked about and as Dave talked about, there's environmental goods coming out of those. And we talk about soil carbon as an environmental good, water quality is an environmental good, nitrate, sediment, greenhouse gases. All of those are outputs of that system. And as we really begin to think about this, I think it's important for us to begin to really think about a much broader system than the way we think about it. Because if we add to this one more piece of this puzzle, and that is that if we look at our adaptation strategies, they really focus on our cropping system. And I'll weave that in as we go towards the end of this. As we go to mitigation strategies, we often think about those as much more of a soil focus. Or something associated with a management input in this. So this whole framework really changes as we begin to do this. So it's a way in which at least I could begin to fathom all the interactions that are going on in this complex thing that we call a cropping system and how it's influenced by the climate change scenarios that are out there. Because in this whole climate variability issue, these patterns in climate, there are impacts on the cropping systems, their environmental or their impacts on environmental goods and services, whether we talk about nitrate levels in streams, whether we talk about sediment coming off, whether we talk about greenhouse gases, all of those are measurable outputs. And yet we often park those in entirely different regimes. We park productivity in one regime, we talk about the environment in another regime, but in reality we have to link those together. Dave talked about what we were going to have to do for producers. This is a way in which we're really going to have to think about this from an entirely different puzzle. Just to bring some reality into this, if we look at just the temperature change from 1901 to 2006, you just look at the changes that have occurred. We see areas of warmed, areas of cooled in general across that, because when we often talk about a changing climate in North America, as everybody kind of thinks about one number for North America, but in reality it's a very diverse set of numbers that exist, the regionality that's there. The nighttime temperatures that have been projected to increase, there's been observations. A lot of people look at this and say, well, that's just kind of the big scale thing that's going on out there. They're projecting in terms of what's going to happen with nighttime temperatures in terms of the future, or whether we talk about a high emission scenario or a low emission scenario. But here's a little dose of reality. Here's Ames, Iowa data. We have been warming during the summer nighttime temperatures since really about 1998. There's variation back, but there's an upward trend of about 1.5 degrees per 10 years in our nighttime temperatures. And if you think about the physiological impacts of just changing the nighttime temperature on how that plant's responding to the environment out there, it's tremendous in terms of what's going on. In 2010, when we had a really high nighttime temperatures events throughout the Midwest, it shortened our grain filling period on corn by about 8 days. That's the impact of what that does. And so we already see some of these things occurring in the record. We just don't often think about them in the context of what we need to be looking at. You do the same thing in terms of precipitation. Again, out of our climate change reports, you realize that there have been areas that have gotten wetter. There have been areas that have gotten drier across that. We tend to, again, look at the U.S. as a total number and say, really hasn't changed much in all of this. But in reality, here's the projected change that's going on. If we look clear to the end of this century, and you would find out that our winters are going to become drier in the south, wetter in the north. Springs are going to become a little wetter in the north, drier in the south. What's most interesting is that since we are a rain-fed agricultural system, the projection by the end of the century is that our summers are going to become much drier. And so when you think about a rain-fed agricultural system becoming much drier, says that we're going to have to really think about how we manage water as part of this puzzle, or we're really going to shift cropping patterns to handle that. The fall becomes drier across the Great Plains. What's occurred already, and we see this again, just you burrow clear down to an individual station, we've looked across other stations in there, is that we've already seen an increase in springtime precipitation when we look at the average of March, April, and May precipitation. This happens to be Ames data. We see this in other stations across Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, all of this, and producers will tell you that there is an increasing amount of storms that are occurring during the spring. The other piece of this, when we come back and look at this puzzle, is that if we classify high rainfall days, high rainfall days being those that have more than 1.25 inches per day, what we see is that early in this century in Des Moines, there was only 2 years that had more than 8 days with these rainfall events. Since 1980, we've had 7 years, actually now 8 years, we need to update this graph. We have 8 years in which we've had more than 8 days with these real high intensity rainfall periods. And so these are occurring in the springtime period. And if you look across the upper Midwest, we think about the potential for erosion. It continues to increase. It degrades our soil resource because it is one of those variability extremes now that is influencing erosion, changing our soil resource, changing our capabilities of how we really handle our agronomic system. You've seen this one as well. Many times we see that this rapid rise of CO2, nitrous oxide, methane in the atmosphere curve that's used over and over again. Throughout most of us in our careers, first started out talking about research around 320, now we're around 390. And so over our careers, we've seen a 70 part per million increase in CO2, in which influences plant response out here. We have lived through climate change. And so all of these different pieces of the puzzle, and so we are a replicate of how we interpret this information and how it happens. maybe the beginning, not the end, right? So in this climate and weather scenario, what we really have is that the realization from an agricultural perspective is that our daily weather is changing, and that the effects of this increasing variability is going to induce some stresses on the cropping system. And all regions of North America are going to experience this changing climate. Some will change more rapidly than others. All of them are going to be impacted, whether we talk about temperature, whether we talk about precipitation. All of this creates a variable tapestry across this agricultural sector that we call North America. So if you think about this framework that we talk about in terms of inputs going through to just our cropping system to an output, is here's our impacts, is that we have water effects on plant growth. We have water effects both from a deficit side as well as an excess side. And unfortunately, we often see those same things occur in the same growing season. The upper Midwest is often too wet in the spring and actually too dry during the late summer. It impacts yield on both ends of the overall process. The temperature effects on plant growth have actually relatively been ignored in terms of lots of different things that are going on. And we've begun to realize just what critical this is in terms of the process. High temperature stresses that are occurring, and very high temperature stresses at very specific phenological stages. If you look at the exposure this summer across the upper Midwest and the Great Plains of having extreme high temperature events during pollination actually had a major impact on crop yields in very localized areas. Central Iowa, not so much. Northwestern Iowa, northeastern Iowa, somewhat. And so we see that impact occurring. And so when you talk to producers, is they'll tell you that there are certain things that are occurring out there. The low temperature piece is that in all of this warming trend out there, we're not going to escape the fact that we're going to have freeze events that occur. Freeze events still are part of that probability cycle of what's going on. They're going to remain that way. And as Dave pointed out in his talk, sometimes they're the oops factor. Because things start growing, they warm up, and all of a sudden we have bud break, and then we receive a major cool down period. We saw that just a few years ago across the wheat belt. The other piece of this puzzle that we can't ignore is the fact that we live in a very complex world, is that these increased temperatures changing everything is going to increase the evaporative demand. There's going to be more water use by these plants. There's going to be more water use demand by the atmosphere into these plants. Is that crop going to have the capability of exploring that profile to be able to meet that soil water capability? If you do this and you just draw this very interesting cycle between what we have in variability of inputs through a cropping system to the output in terms of yield, is that we end up with these variable graphs that go on. And if you look at U.S. corn yields, yes, that curve does go up. It goes out at about 1.96 bushels per year. But in reality, there are drops in this. And what has become very fascinating to me is the magnitudes of these declines that are occurring. Because if we look at these depressions in here, everybody talks about how bad the blight was. Blight was about an 18% drop in terms of U.S. production, as opposed to we drought occurrences of 26, 29%, the floods of 93 in terms of about 18%. Wet spring with an early frost, again compressing both ends of that spectrum at a 16% reduction. So we deal in these types of reductions that are out here. And so as we look across crops, what we really begin to see is that there's lots of interesting patterns. This happens to be Kansas alfalfa, combination of dry land and irrigated. And what's interesting in the Kansas alfalfa data is just how variable it is from year to year. And part of that, as we believe, is really related back to the fact that we get a really good year of alfalfa growth, and alfalfa is an extremely deep-rooted crop. It pulls out all the soil moisture that it needs almost a year of recharge in order to refill that profile to come back. And you see the same thing that exists in some of the deep-rooted forage crops that are out there. It has some real implications for our discussions about energy crops, because those are extremely high water use crops at all. But everybody's ignored the soil water component of those. And so there's going to be some extreme variability of climate that goes with these. This happens to be Georgia corn. You can see the input of irrigation later in that record. Early in that record, what's fascinating is that almost every other year is a high year and a low year in that record. And so you almost have two yield trends across that, a high pattern and a low pattern. You don't see any real excesses of high production out of the Georgia yields. You basically, because it tends to be a much more of a temperature problem that really limits it during the grain filling period. And so those things begin to emerge out of our record as well. And then I've been narrowing this down even farther and looking at this. This happens to be Story County, where Ames is located. We've actually got a whole suite of these counties across that. And what you see is that there's a depression in 1978. We lost yield clear back to the levels almost of the lowest year in the 1940s. And there are other years. But when you look at the average decline in yield, or average depression in yield caused by weather over this period from 1940 to 2010, is there's a 17% reduction in yield from the potential maximum every year. And so we lose about 17%. A lot of our other Iowa counties, some are at 13%, some are at 20% from what we could potentially produce within that county. So weather is really having a major impact on what we do on a year-to-year basis. Both from an excess as well as a shortage, and I'll explain that just in a second. This happens to be Canada wheat yields. Canada wheat yields continue to climb, as we see in other records, but there's extreme variability in those yield records, again, because it's a weather and a water-driven system. This is coming off the high plains of the Great Plains of Canada, the prairies. And so we see that there's a water-limited system, much more on the deficit side than on the excess side. Mexico wheat production, a lot of this is irrigated. And we look at this record, there's an interesting thing in this, because we've seen less irrigation being applied to these crops across that. So it's beginning to change that temporal pattern of that yield into the future. The bottom line is that if you look at that first box in terms of inputs through a cropping system, finally to yield out there, is that we do have an impact of weather every year, every location. The magnitude changes, but in reality, those pieces need to be put together. If we're going to develop this, we have to understand just how these dynamics work. Because water's often a limitation. It's across that, and it's primarily a function of soil water availability. And it is on both ends of the extreme. It is from the excess side to the limitation side. 2010 is a perfect example of the excess side across across most of Iowa. We actually had 1,000 plus millimeters during the summer season. That exceeds almost our annual rainfall in a lot of cases. And we had actually water deficits because of too much water. We had excessive demand, too much water in the soil profile. The plant actually couldn't take enough water because of limited root systems. So we see that. The temperature effects, we see reductions in wheat yields across the Great Plains, often associated with late spring freezes. So you look at the real declines in wheat yields across Kansas, North Dakota, South Dakota. A lot of those you can relate back to late spring temperature events. But rising temperatures are affecting yields. And I think we've really underestimated just how important these rising nighttime temperatures are on the yield components that are going on, and the rising nighttime temperatures in terms of the length of the grain filling period and the temperature extremes during pollination. A lot of the work that's been done, David Lobel from Stanford has been looking at temperature effects in a much more of a statistical approach on a worldwide basis. He's analyzed this and shown that there's already declines in production because of the rising temperatures that are out there. And I think we need to be paying attention to the fact of how this is changing on a worldwide basis as well as a regional. Schenker and Roberts use a temperature model, a statistical temperature model, that is even scarier if you read their paper. They're talking about projected yield declines of 50, 60, 80% across the upper Midwest because of their temperature extremes that are out there. And I think those need to be examined, and we need, as physiologists and agronomists, need to be involved in helping them interpret their temperature responses out there. So going back to this expanded framework and concentrating on the adaptation strategies that we have out there, is that adaptation is really something we've been doing to the cropping system. We think about it as a way in which we can reduce the impact of climate stresses. We think about changing planting dates. We think about changing the hybrid or cultivar maturity date. Irrigation is always thrown up as a first thing that everybody wants out there, but you have to have water resources to irrigate. And the other one is change in equipment. And we've already seen this across the upper Midwest because we've had wetter and wetter springs, is that producers are going to larger and larger equipment so that they can plant more and more over a shorter window of time. We sell a lot of 36-row planters these days. And this year we planted 70% of the state of Iowa in 1 week in corn. That tells you something about the capability with modern equipment to really put in a crop. The other one that's fascinating is if you look at the shifts in crop rotations and cropping systems, and I'll use some examples from North Dakota, South Dakota. This is South Dakota area, wheat, corn, sorghum, soybeans and sunflowers. You see this very dotted line, that's a precipitous rise in sunflower acreage across South Dakota just because of the change that's out there. And they've adapted to that. We see a little bit of that change in North Dakota. And here's the U.S. corn map. It used to be that you hardly saw any green area west of the Red River, and now it's intruded clear into North Dakota, South Dakota. Major change that's out there. And so finally, mitigation, I'll make that very quick, is our really focus is on soil management practices. Whether we talk about carbon, as Dave and Chuck talked about, nitrogen management in terms of emissions, all of these things become part of our overall puzzle that's there. But the point in terms of soil carbon is that we've got to look at it from a water holding capacity, because this magic 300 bushel corn that everybody wants is going to take 120 millimeters of more water transpired by that crop in order to achieve that yield, unless we really get very, very good at how we get the biotech, the biology into that to make it more water use efficiency. So with that, I'll give you the challenges, is that we need to understand that climate has a major impact on growth and yield. We've got to identify and quantify these linkages and their feedbacks among adaptation, mitigation, and impacts. Those three boxes in there, we need to understand how they all fit together, and we really do need to quantify these interactions among temperature, water, carbon dioxide, and solar radiation all together, because there will be some shifts in solar radiation that occur as well in all of this. And so all of these are going to have to come together, not as single entities, but as an integrated part of the overall system, so that we truly understand not only how to adapt, but what the role of mitigation strategies would be at the other side. So with that, thank you.
There are some questions for Jerry. Yeah. Quickly, because we need to get on, but we want discussion.
Yep.
The reason we're here is rising temperatures in the Midwest, so I wonder how you came up with that conclusion.
What, the rising temperatures affecting yields?
Yeah, because there is no evidence of rising temperatures in the Midwest.
Actually, if you look across the the data records that we've been looking at and the graph that I showed you from Ames is that we do see rising minimum temperatures. It's not that the max is changing, it's the minimum. And so what we're doing is we have a hot, lot larger respiration rate at night.
Yeah, but there are a lot of papers out there showing that there is no clear trend for the Midwest. So, I mean, it's just a comment.
Well,
Yeah, and
let me just, and I put those up just to show you what's in the literature out there and the place that which physiologists and agronomists really need to get engaged in this debate to understand this, both from a empirical point of view as well as a modeling point of view. As Jim pointed out in his talk, what we're trying to do is assemble that information about CO2, temperature, water, solar radiation interactions, so that we really do improve our capabilities of understanding this in the future.
Great. Let's thank Jerry again. And we...